The Cycling Podcast, in association with Rafa. From grand tours to group rides, the Champs-Élysées to coffee shops, Rafa exists to celebrate the world's most beautiful sport.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore. I'm with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
Up there in sunny Watford.
Not Watford.
And Daniel Freib.
Freiber. Daniel Freiber. Daniel Freiber.
Ah, I'm glad 18 months of living with Rob Hatch has served some useful purpose.
It's the return of the pronunciation police, putting me in my place there. Excellent. How are you both, chaps?
Very strong, well, thank you.
Very strong, very strong. Snowing here, Rich.
Snowing in Berlin. You're in the Berlin office of the Cycling Podcast. We are going to be talking mainly about Milan-San Remo in this episode. It was a race that a lot of people enjoyed, I think, and a significant winner in Vincenzo Nibali. So we'll dedicate most of the episode to that. But before we get on with that, Lionel, can we crack on with the news roundup, please?
We certainly can, Rich. Yes, it was a weekend of impressive solo breaks, wasn't it? Vincenzo Nibali won Milan-San Remo, making it back-to-back monument victories for him because he won in Lombardia at the end of last season. In the women's race, the Trofeo Alfredo Binda on Sunday, Kasia Nowodoma of Poland won with a similarly impressive break, going around 10 kilometres from the end. Milan-San Remo was all about Nibali. We'll talk about that in the bulk of this episode, but just a couple of things, just in case we don't mention them later on. It was the first Italian victory since Filippo Pozzato in 2006 in Milan-San Remo, so no wonder the Italians were cock-a-hoop after the finish. The big sprinters were all
Peacock-a-hoop.
Peacock-a-hoop, of course. They're Peacock of Sandrigio. The Sandrigio.
Is it Sandrigio? Sandrigio.
Sandrigio. Sandrigio. There's a chapter by Ciro in our book, the Cycling Podcast book, A Journey Through the Cycling Year, all about Pozzato. Almost a love letter to Pozzato. Not sure whether that
was... almost about it.
Well,
almost a sex text, more like it.
oh my word. Not sure whether that entices people to buy the book or not. It's a lovely piece. So Italy's long wait for a Milan-San Remo winner again is over. And Nibali timed his move absolutely perfectly. An attack on the Poggio, we'll talk all about that later on. The other notable events from the race, Marcel Kittel was dropped on the Capo Berta and then dropped really for good on the Cipressa. Not a race for him. I'd speculated last week that about whether or not Milan-San Remo would be for him this year. Clearly not. Mark Cavendish had a really bad looking crash around 10 kilometres to go as they were heading towards the Poggio, traffic island in the middle of the road. Nobody seemed to be there with a flag. Clearly didn't see it and went right over the top of it, and the sort of disturbing aspect of it was his shoe was left on the top of the bollard. He'd gone head over heels.
Was that the most disturbing aspect of it?
Well, it just showed the force of the impact to me. That kind of brought it. Obviously, seeing him, in the fetal position on the floor was distressing enough. But, I think it brings it home to you, the force of the crash and the way he'd hit that bollard.
True.
Took his shoe off. There was also a crash for André Greipel. He will miss the rest of the classics as a result. But it was all about Nibali's move, and we'll discuss how brilliant that was and the what went on behind later on. The women's race, the Trofeo Alfredo Binda, was held in pretty grim conditions, cold and wet. And Nowodoma went with around 10 kilometres to go, looked very strong on the climb and very strong on the flat, and really opened up the gap well and won convincingly. Chantal Black and Marianne Vos made it two Dutch riders on the podium. If anyone's wondering why it's called the Trofeo Alfredo Binda, well, Alfredo Binda was an Italian rider who won the Giro five times. Was he, the first rider to win the Giro five times? He was racing from the sort of early 20s to the mid 30s. He also won Milan-San Remo twice, and he's from Citiglio. Is that right, Daniel? Is that the pronunciation?
Citiglio.
No, that's Citiglio.
No, Citiglio.
Citiglio. Good.
Where's Rob Hatch when you need him?
Well, he yeah. So that's where the race is held. Anyone of sort of our generation, Rich, will probably remember Binder toe straps. Which anyone wondering what toe straps are, they were what we had before we had clipless pedals. When you had to strap your foot to the pedal, it seems like another world away now. But yeah, a little bit of history there.
And actually, was Sean Kelly not the last man to win a classic with toe straps? Milan San Remo. Ooh,
that's a good question. I'd have to look at the pictures, but yeah, I think you're probably right. He didn't transfer over until really, really at the end.
I think he's using toe clips and straps when he won Milan San Remo. So we've just done completed some kind of circle there. Yeah.
The other notable thing about that Milan San Remo 92 was that he was paid an awful lot of money to wear a Brancali helmet, which was the ugliest.
Whatever he was paid, it wasn't enough.
Well, it was an ugly looking thing, but he only went back to get it from the car with about sort of 40 kilometres to go. He didn't want to wear it all day. You didn't have to wear a helmet racing in Italy in those days. But yeah, it looked like an upturned pudding bowl, but clearly the money was worth it. In other racing, the Tour of Catalonia is underway. As we speak, the first stage has been run off and won by Álvaro Hodeg.
Álvaro Hodge.
Well, a timely intervention there from the pronunciation police.
No relation of the England 1980s midfielder Steve Hodge, we should point out.
Stephen Hodge, the old Festina rider, Australian, for that matter. That'd be more likely, wouldn't it? A cyclist. Well, he's Scottish, as we now know. Ali Hodge.
Did you?
Hodgey.
On the march with Ali's army, eh?
I would have loved it if when he was interviewed after winning the Hans Am Classic, whether if he just opened his mouth in a broad Glaswegian accent.
Well, tell the story.
It's only sort of dribbling out, and it was actually Rob Hatch that alerted me to this because he was commentating on the Hans Am Classic on Friday on Eurosport, and he pronounced the name as you did, Lionel Hodeg, and he then was sent some messages from, I don't know whether Spanish-speaking or Colombian viewers, telling him that actually Álvaro, nobody had heard the name Hodeg, so he pronounces it Hodge. And the story seems to be that his grandfather was a Scottish fisherman who moved to Colombia, and the name perhaps was misspelt when he got there, so the G and the E were put the wrong way around, so Hodge became Hodeg, but he pronounces it Hodge. And welcome aboard, Ali.
The Scots are already trying to sign him up for the Commonwealth Games.
Put a kilt on him. I think moves are afoot to try and get him signed up for the Commonwealth Games. I imagine that would go down well with Patrick Lefebvre at Quickstep.
Well, it's about what is this Commonwealth Games? Who cycles in this Commonwealth Games?
He's about as Scottish as Mark O. Pantani was Irish.
But on a serious note, whether he's Scottish or Colombian, he looks like a little sensation. You know, Quickstep lost Fernando Gaviria for Milan San Remo through injury after his crash, and in the space of a week, Hodge has won the Hans Zema Classic and a stage of the Tour of Catalonia, and clearly looks like another talent. And going back to talking to Patrick Lefebvre about how he spots riders, I mean, it sounds obvious, but he did say at the Vuelta, didn't he, last year, "Well, I have eyes everywhere."
Well,
clearly has.
Well, Napalm, Quickstep, I mean, people might be wondering how come they've got these two prodigious Colombian riders. They did actually employ a very well-known talent scout, Fernandez Machin, for a couple of years. He's actually left now, and he's reunited with Mauro Gennetti at the UAE team. But Machin had been a director sportivo Mapei, Sornier de Vel, various other teams, and he was being used by Quickstep as a talent scout, particularly focusing on the sort of Hispanic market for a couple of years. And he's come up trumps with Hodge, and Gaviria, hasn't he? I don't know if you saw the sprint yesterday in Catalunya, but I think the technical term for the sprint that old Hodge pulled out is absolutely mustard.
It was. It was a very, very fast finish, wasn't it? Michael Merku as well has been a good signing for Quickstep. He did a great job. And, I mean, yeah, he rinsed it, didn't he, to use another technical term. He absolutely rinsed it super fast. And he does look extremely, extremely talented. Poor old Gaviria will be, you know, feeling a little bit... It's an amazing team for that, isn't it? You had Gaviria coming through while Kittel was still there. And, you know, they've got just got this conveyor belt of talent there.
Indeed. But shall we turn our attentions back to Milan-San Remo, the big race of the weekend, first monument of the season, kind of the beginning of the classics. Not really much in common between Milan-San Remo and the cobbled classics, to be honest. But what were your thoughts?
Well, it was, as ever, a really fascinating race because, as everybody says, it's an easy race to finish, relatively speaking, but a very, very hard race to win. And you know, when you've got, Vincenzo Nibali, a guy that we know from the Grand Tours, winning Grand Tours, and he's won all three, winning ahead of Caleb Ewan, you know, a pure sprinter, that tells you everything, really, about Milan-San Remo, doesn't it? Because it's one of the only races where guys like that can go head-to-head. I mean, Caleb Ewan rode a very good race. His teammate, you mentioned, Matteo Trentin, put in a bit of a bid to try and catch Nibali, and it looked at one point like he might do it, and then you'd have fancied Trentin in the sprint. Didn't work out, and I think Caleb Ewan was maybe annoyed that Trentin didn't, because it looked like the Mitchelton-Scott plan was very much to support Caleb Ewan. He was surrounded by teammates for a lot of the race. They did a really good job, and Trentin perhaps went off script going after Nibali in the way that he did.
I think it was a typical move, Rich, of a guy who's been sort of kept away in his hutch or in his kennel for a few years, working for more decorated riders, more famous riders, and Trentin has been desperate to get off the leash. And the first opportunity he's had in a big race was San Remo on Saturday. And yeah, it's difficult to know, you know, what the instructions were from the DS, but you know, Milan-San Remo is a really, really fascinating race because it hinges on these tiny factors, these tiny variables. And, you know, we've talked, certainly last year and I think the year before, I talked a lot about hesitation and the role it plays in San Remo and how, you know, a moment's hesitation will always affect the outcome in Milan-San Remo. And, you know, one of the factors that definitely, I think, played a role in Nibali staying away was Trentin going away. You know, both in terms of the help that Ewan didn't get, but also in the effect that had on the bunch. And, you know, similarly with Nibali's attack, Nibali launched the attack when his Bahrain Merida team were on the front. And he launched it in on a part of the Poggio where it was a bit earlier than we usually see attacks in Milan-San Remo. So there was a moment's hesitation there, both because Bahrain were on the front and no one, well, everyone was sort of taking a few seconds to organise their chase, and also because they didn't expect the attack to come then. And then there was also the Latvian rider, Chris Nylands, was up the road at that time, and he was also essential. But all of these things probably made a second or 2 seconds difference, and that is why Milan-San Remo is so fascinating, because that ultimately was the difference between Nibali staying away and getting caught. I mean, Milan-San Remo's the only classic I think that you sort of analyze with a microscope rather than a telescope. The other monuments, Flanders and Lombardy particularly, and Liège, the narratives kind of play out with these sort of planetary rhythms. You know, things happen quite slowly. There's a chance to correct mistakes, and that's simply not the case with Milan-San Remo. There was a good phrase that one of the Italian journalists, Cristiano Gatti, used on Sunday in his analysis of the races. He said it's 7 hours of the grind of modern life and a 15-minute electrocution at the end, and that's kind of what it felt like.
Well, on that point, really, I was just going to ask Daniel, I mean, what you thought, because the way that Groupama FDJ controlled things so well and looked really in control on the Cipressa, Ignatius Konovalovas and Matthew Ladon.
Man of the match, well, I think he was fantastic.
There's talk about the headwind and, you know, the fact that it was a, relatively speaking, slow ascent, but obviously, you know, the wind would have been responsible for that. But the fact that there was really... you know, nothing doing on the Cipressa. You know, that almost kind of kept the lid on the bottle for longer than perhaps we've seen. Normally you see something kind of kick off a bit more on the Cipressa, don't we? But it all came down to really that one moment, really. There was really only one moment in the race, and it was Nibali, and the timing of it, you would have thought it was too far from the top, but actually that's exactly what he needed in order to open up that gap. And it really was a matter of seconds, wasn't it? Because if he'd gone over the top with just, you know, even 3 or 4 seconds less than he had, he wouldn't have had that advantage coming onto the final running when it all flattens out.
I mean, there's that moment where he went, and the fact that he went after Nayland, who... not a rider that people would have been perhaps looking out for. That was an amazing performance from him. He opened it up. He was the catalyst for Nibali to get away, and Nibali was away. And I suspect in that moment, a lot of people probably looked at Peter Sagan to bring it back, to close it. And Sagan had a couple of teammates with him at that point. And he didn't. And he perhaps, you know, having been caught out like that before himself, didn't want to fall into that trap and hesitated. And the race was done. And the defending champion, Michał Kwiatkowski, said that he had a couple of goes. But by then it was really too late. And Nibali had flown. And I mean, we'll talk about Nibali, I think, more in the next part. But you mentioned FDJ and Arnaud Démare, another former winner. He was third. I thought that team was just incredibly impressive the way they rode. And I think back to the Tour de France last year when he was ill, and there were two stages in the Jura and in the Alps where he was off the back and eventually eliminated on the stage into Chambéry. And I remember him being surrounded by, I think, 3 or 4 teammates and same guys who were with him on Saturday at Milan-San Remo, really, saying that they were, you know, that it was for love, you know, that there was this incredible bond between them, and you know that they weren't acting on instructions from the team. They wanted to help Démare get to the finish, and I thought they rode on Saturday at Milan-San Remo like that. Like, there's an incredibly strong bond between them, and they were absolutely committed to Démare. And you know, he finished on the podium again, a good result. Nobody talks about it because everybody talks about Nibali, but I was very impressed by that team's performance.
The other team that really did try something, I guess you have to say, is Border, because the German champion Marcus Burkhardt, you know, went very hard at the bottom of the Poggio, got a gap. At one point, Jean-Pierre Drucker of BMC was with him. They kind of did have a little bit of a gap, but and then later on, once Nibali had gone, Daniel Oss then was trying to you know, drag things back together again for Bora and for Peter Sagan. Didn't quite work, and I think that again highlights just how well timed and well executed Nibali's move was. Just a little, I don't want to be flippant about this issue at all, but given that last week we were talking about the Giro going to Israel, and you know, I've written a little bit about this on my soon to be defunct blog, the fact that, you know, we talk about the big issues of the Giro going to Israel, but it was interesting to me that Nayland's the Latvian champion riding for the Israel Academy team, you know, you could argue he almost set up Vincenzo Nibali riding for the Bahrain team. I mean, you know, there's quite an interesting juxtaposition there. I don't really want to sort of extrapolate some great meaning from that, but you know, we have teams sponsored by you know, by Israel and by Bahrain there cooperating or collaborating or coexisting in the peloton, And that was just a little moment that
I don't think it was deliberate, though.
No, I don't think it was. But I mean, but you know, they're in the same bunch, aren't they? Daniel made the point last week about the peloton being a society on wheels, and it is. You know, there's you know, room for everyone.
And just
the enemy of my enemy is my friend.
and just from a technical point of view, Lionel, I think the contribution, it was only about a 200 meter contribution of Nylund's, was absolutely essential for Nibali. You know, we've talked so much these days, and it's become an unfashionable term, but we talk so much about marginal gains, and again, just to labour the point slightly, but that's what it really came down to on Saturday. And you know, the fact that Nibali did attack really before everyone expected him to attack, they weren't Sagan, Kwiatkowski, the guys who, and Gilbert to a certain extent, although he'd had problems before the Poggio, the guys who you would have expected to go with him weren't quite ready for it. There's a spot on the Poggio just after the church, just as you come into the village at the top, where everyone always attacks. And Nibali went well before that. And I think the fact that he was on his own ultimately actually helped him. And it kind of surprises me that we don't see more solo attacks succeeding on the Poggio, because, you know, that is a great antidote to that hesitation, which is fatal in Milan-San Remo. When two or three riders together, there is always a moment. It might only be a second or a split second when they look at each other and they're trying to suss out who's the strongest in the group. And that moment ultimately proves fatal for them in the end. Whereas Nibali knew that he was not going to get any help. He knew that no one was going to catch him, or that, you know, before the last kilometer. And he just had to put his head down and go. And that's what he did. And, you know, it was also vital, I think, you know, talking about fine margins, that he was actually hoodwinked slightly by his team car, his director sportif in the team car, who told him that he had 20 seconds when in fact he had about 12 at the top. But again, you know, races, well, like this, or particularly Milan-San Remo, do come down to tiny details like that.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much to our sponsor, Science and Sport, for continuing to back the Cycling Podcast. We're very grateful.
You make it
to them.
Sound, Rich, you make it sound there as though we've been involved in some terrible public humiliation. And in spite of that, they've decided to stick by us through thick and thin.
Well, there might be some truth in that. I don't know. But, well, they have. I mean, they are backing us again this year. And they'll be their support will help us to go to all three Grand Tours, starting with the Giro very soon. You can get 25% off all your Science and Sport products at scienceandsport.com with the code... Lionel, with the code...
Oh, no. I can't remember.
Daniel, the code...
I don't know. I'm too busy thinking about how my mention of the Ciro Pozzato sex text might be precisely that public humiliation that Science and Sport might have to stick by us through.
I'm just testing there, chaps. SISCP25. SISCP25 at scienceandsport.com. Thank you, Science and Sport. Now, we were going to talk in this bit about Nibali, and, you know, a lot of it seems to have elevated him in the discussion around Nibali to, you know, where does he belong in the pantheon? You know, he's now won all three Grand Tours. He'd won the Il Lombardia twice. He's now won another monument. You know, not many riders have won all three Grand Tours. Not many riders have won more than one monument. And I think we're wondering as well, what else can he win? He's gone fairly close, or reasonably close, in Liège-Bastogne-Liège before. He has said that this year, he's riding the Tour de France this year, but he said that he's, you know, he was coming into this year looking at trying to win some of the classics. And he's unusual, I suppose, in the sense of being such an established GC rider who is also who races with panache, and he's great, he's good at winning. You know, he won a memorable stage at the Vuelta last year, he won a good stage at the Giro, and he's won stages at the Tour de France, of course, as well. He is not a conservative, calculating sort of rider, is he? He can be quite swashbuckling when he wants to be.
Well, certainly, Rich, I would agree with that. And Milan-San Remo in particular is, I mean, it's a race that's much maligned, and I saw people maligning the course even on Saturday, saying that, you know, it was boring, but that is kind of the point. And, you know, people say it's a lottery. It is a lottery, but not in the sense that people mean. I mean, people say that because they're suggesting that it's random, that anyone can win. It is a lottery in the sense that it's almost impossible that that a guy like Nibali is going to win, but you can't call it impossible as long as there is a tiny glimmer of hope. And he ultimately latched onto that and grabbed that hope, and he had a winning ticket on Saturday. But I think it was really a victory of a testament to his will and how much Milan Sanremo means to an Italian rider like Nibali. Because if you take out the sprinters, the guys who really should be winning Milan Sanremo, there are probably 15 or 20 guys in the peloton who have physiological characteristics more suited to an attack on the Poggio and staying away. And yet, Nibali has tried four times now on the Poggio, and he's ultimately won a Milan-San Remo. And I think he's done that through pure desire and pure will to make it happen, to go against those odds. And, that's typical of the way he races. But as I said, I think it's typical also, or it says a lot about where he knows he now stands in the pantheon of professional cycling and Italian cycling. And he also knows that no Italian cyclist can be considered completely fulfilled, and their palmarès cannot be considered complete without a Milan-San Remo, because it is that important in Italian cycling. And just I wasn't there on Saturday, but listening to people and looking at La Gazzetta dello Sport, for example, the next day, they had 7 pages on Milan-San Remo. Every single article was about Nibali. They completely ignored the rest of the race. And, I felt a bit uncomfortable actually reading it, because it was a bit too gushing. It was a bit too effusive. They were calling him the pride of Italy terms and a sort of tone of coverage that I think we should perhaps be careful, or with the past has taught us to be careful about sort of lapsing into. But nonetheless, as I say, it really does sort of crown him as the prince of Italian cycling, and puts him on a similar level to Coppi and Binder and Girardengo and those great names.
And I think what captures people's imagination, Nibali's hardly an underdog. He's a champion, but to see him winning a race, as you say, against the odds like that, when you've got the sprinters kind of poised and waiting, and with teammates around them, and all the support that they need, in that scenario, in that context, Nibali is almost like a plucky underdog, and that makes the win all the sweeter. And it's why sort of neutrals were probably rooting for him. And it's just interesting how this victory resonates so much more than winning the Tour of Lombardy, which comes at the end of the season when a lot of riders have switched off. It's a more selective kind of race, and one where luck is less of a factor, or timing, or whatever you want to call it. And also, I think because Milan-San Remo was the first of the season, isn't it? Because it's the big sort of opener, the first big fixture on the calendar. I think that also just means that Milan-San Remo resonates even more.
Yeah, and I think the way the race pans out, you think, well, all these sprinters have won it down the years. It's a sprinter's race. If you look at the last 30-odd years, the number of sprinters have won it by many times outnumbers the number of times that even sort of small breaks have gone away. And then there's been the kind of the bolt from a cannon type wins by Pozzato springs to mind, Cancellara springs to mind. But the fact that the sprinters don't have any help left is really telling, isn't it? And I think that just shows, that again just shows how strong Nibali had to be to get away and get that gap, because you'd think convention would say, well, surely there's going to be 2, 3 or 4 teammates, particularly a team like Quickstep or Groupama, although Groupama really sort of used up their strength a bit earlier in the race. It just kind of shows you how difficult it is to pull off what Nibali pulled off at the weekend. And the fact that he's been at such a level for coming up for a decade now. I mean, he was sixth in the 2009 Tour. And he's still at the top of his game now. I mean, that's it's not a surprise win either, is it? It's not like he's a bolt from the blue. He's been trying to win this race for many years, and he's finally done it.
Lionel, and just on your point about the sprinters not having trains left, or not having many riders left to help them at the end. I mean, that to me is what invalidates the claim, the clamour for the route to change. I think it's still a fantastic race and it's still a fantastic route precisely for that reason. That the attrition and the length of the race, you know, it's 300 kilometres, does still make a difference in modern cycling. You know, we see races nowadays getting harder and harder, or people wanting them to get harder and harder, but that 300 kilometers is still very unusual. Well, it's unique in modern cycling, and it still does make a huge difference. And just on Nibali and his place in the pantheon, I mean, if we think in terms of palmares and if a rider starting in his career and knowing roughly what kind of rider he's going to be and what could he possibly win, well, I think Nibali is nearing the point where his palmarès is almost complete. I mean, there's almost no one in the history of professional cycling, I would say, has had a complete palmarès. Even Eddy Merckx didn't win Paris-Tours, for example. The closest, I think, to a rider who's really won everything they should have won or would have wanted to win in their careers would be Paolo Bettini, I would say, who won two Worlds and Olympics. He won a Liège, a Lombardy, a San Remo, and Italian championships. And he won stages in all three Grand Tours. Nibali, I would suggest, is lacking a World Championships and a Liège. And beyond that, I mean, you could throw in a Flèche Wallonne, but that race is not really perceived as being as prestigious as it once was. And I think that puts him in the very top bracket, you know, how close he is to really assembling a complete collection of races that he could or would have wanted to win.
Here's a question for you. I mean, he's riding the Tour de France again this year, but you have a sense almost that races like Milan-San Remo, maybe Liège, Bastogne-Liège are perhaps a higher priority. The World Championships this year too in Innsbruck could be one that really suits him. Would he rather, or would it be better for him to win another Grand Tour or to win a Liège or a World Championship?
Well, I think another Tour de France is a several levels above winning, say, another Giro or another Vuelta. But a world title would certainly be a welcome addition. I'm wondering about the Tour of Flanders, because he's riding that for the first time this year. And when I mentioned that before we started recording, Daniel said, well, how long is it since a 65-kilo guy won the Tour of Flanders, which is a good point. I hadn't really thought about it. I mean, I just thought, well, you know, if he can win Lombardy, if he can win Milan-San Remo, why not the Tour of Flanders? But it would be really fascinating to see how he gets on in that race, because in terms of the climbing, that's no problem at all. But in terms of having the oomph and the grunt to get over the climbs with the real specialists, that would, you know, that's a question that we may see answered.
Well, the last one, Napalm, was Michele Bartoli, another Italian, in 1996, wasn't it? Very, very similar build to Nibali, not quite as tall, but the same weight, sort of 64, 65 kilograms, but more of a, well, he was a classic specialist, wasn't he? But morphologically pretty similar. But, you know, the climbing per se is not going to be a problem. And the racecraft, I mean, Nibali lacks experience and he doesn't know the roads. But having said that, we've sort of purred in the past when we've watched him in those couple of cobbled stages at the Tour de France. We've absolutely marvelled at how loose and agile he is on a bike and how he's found gaps and you know, he's ridden down gutters and to avoid trouble and so forth. I would suggest it's probably not going to be enough for him to contend, and it's probably late in his career to start thinking about, you know, building up enough experience to be able to contend in the next two or three years. But I think he might surprise us. You know, there are a number of Grand Tour riders who are talking about doing some races on the cobbles in the next few weeks. I think Quintana's going to do one or two. Lander, I saw today, is going to do. Harald Becker. And with those guys, I think we'll see them, you know, pull out after 120, 150 kilometres. With Nibali, it wouldn't shock me if you know, he's up there on the Koppenberg or not too far from the front in the Tour of Flanders, so after 200 kilometres or more.
A community around the world. Stories and films with the most compelling characters. The world's finest apparel. Explore the world of cycling with Rafa.
thank you very much to our main sponsor, Rafa, for supporting us through thick and thin. Just before you say it, Daniel, very grateful to Rafa and Science and Sport. And very grateful to you as well, the listeners who have signed up as friends of the podcast. You also help us to get to races, and in particular the three Grand Tours, with our daily coverage beginning at the Giro soon. We have a new friend special to release. It'll be coming out later this week, I think.
Which one's this, Rich? Is this your trip to Belgium to see the next generation?
The next generation. That could be the title. Oh,
there we are.
Lionel. Yeah. Well, it's, yeah, I went to East Flanders recently and stayed a few nights with Tim Harris and Jocelyn Ryan. Tim Harris, a former British professional, of course. Some of you may be familiar with him.
National road race champion.
He was national race champion.
1989?
And he rode for an early incarnation of the Festina team. He rode in Portugal quite a lot as well.
Tim Harris seems to me like the kind of guy who should have an absolutely belting nickname.
Well, that's your job, Daniel.
We need to come up with
one,
don't we?
Yeah, he now runs a chair business, but he's lived in Belgium since he retired. And for about 15 years now, he and Jocelyn have had a house nearby in Tielt Wing, where Eddie Merckx was born, as you'll know, Daniel. And
really?
Different.
So, next door to, next village.
Well, yeah.
Near. Close,
okay.
Close.
Yeah. There's a statue there. I went to see the statue of Eddie Merckx. But yeah, they have a big house there, which is the home every year to between 6 and 10 or 12 young riders who are aspiring to turn professional. They take in riders every year, a lot of them funded by the Dave Rayner Fund. And the riders they've had through that house is a who's who of professional cycling, really, from Mark Cavendish to most recently Fernando Gaviria, who actually lived in their own house nearby. Dan McClay lived in their own house as well. Adam Blythe, Lizzie Armitstead. But lots of riders, a lot of British riders, but a lot from elsewhere as well. They've got an amazing book with all the... And Chris Froome spent a year there as well. So you've got an amazing sort of visitor book with messages and signatures and photos and so on. So I went over there, spent a few days with them, spoke to them about what they do, how they do it, and also met some of the young riders who have entered the house this year. It does feel a bit like Big Brother, although they don't get voted out. And we've actually left a couple of them tasked with keeping audio diaries for the year. So we hope at the end of the year to release an episode or episodes covering their year of trying to turn pro. But this first episode will go out this week, and it will be the whole story behind the house, the Tim Harris and Jocelyn Ryan story, and also an interview with John Barclay, who is 88 years old now, and for over 40 years he's been taking young riders across to Belgium to race pretty much every weekend, and he's still doing it now. A fascinating character, and again, the list of riders he's taken to Belgium is a who's who, really. So really interesting, points of view, experiences, stories from people that we don't maybe hear enough of, and they perform a very vital role. Let's hear a little story now, a little clip from the episode. This is Tim Harris telling us his favourite memory of Fernando Gaviria.
The best story I've got about Fernando is, so basically we went out for the day, and we came back, and we got a pretty big lawn, as you've seen. And the lawn was mowed. So Fernando Gaviria had just mowed the lawn, so we'd never really seen a lawnmower before. He just spent the day doing the lawn. So not one cyclist out of anybody else ever would have dreamt of going into the garage, looking at the lawnmower, getting the lawnmower and doing the grass. And then I came in, he didn't mention it. I said, what have you been up to?
I think he'd seen me do it the week before, and he thought, oh, I fancy it.
That looks like
machine,
fun.
That machine looks good.
So, things like that. And then he wanted to play football in the garden. So it was like...
we all had to go and play football.
We had to go and play football. Five-a-side football, except the three of us. Or four of us.
And if there was nobody there, you were not there once. He just went outside by himself and did keepy uppy.
Yeah.
By himself.
So
no one to play with.
Well, Rich, that was Tim. I was expecting to hear, Fernando is in the diary room. After you comparing it to Big Brother.
Well, funnily enough, I was going to suggest it. I've solved cycling's problems using social media. Why don't they have a stage race where the public vote riders out after each stage. They could vote, and they can vote whoever they want out, and then the winner at the end of the race is a combination of the strongest and most popular. It could be an absolute game changer.
I think that's the worst. That's the worst idea I've ever heard,
Lionel. I think you need to give it a rest with the gimmicky suggestions. I was speaking to someone very high up in the Abu Dhabi tour a few days ago, and they had listened to our podcast about the Dubai and Abu Dhabi tours, in which you suggested that they should turn it into some kind of wacky races, you know, points race affair. What they have done is announced that those two races are going to be combined next year, and it's going to be a 7-day UAE tour.
So they didn't like my idea?
No, Lionel. No, I don't think you'll be invited next year.
Just to return briefly to the latest friend special. To become a friend of the podcast, go to thecyclingpodcast.com. It costs £15 for the year, and by signing up, you will get exclusive episodes like this one. There's a few more in the pipeline, and you will also be supporting us. And everybody who's signed up so far, thank you very much. We're very grateful. We should also mention, because we haven't mentioned it for a couple of weeks, our book, Our Journey Through the Cycling Year, with diaries from all of us at the three Grand Tours and other chapters as well. That is available at all the usual outlets. And thank you very much for your feedback on that so far. Please keep it coming. We want to know what you think.
And as we've got the Grand Prix Hawerbeke coming up on Friday, Gent Wevelgem on Sunday, and Dwars Door Vlaanderen next Wednesday, it's actually moved dates, Dwars Door Vlaanderen. It's a week later. So it falls between Gent Wevelgem and the Tour of Flanders this year. If you didn't sign up as a friend of the podcast last year, that's still available. It's £10 for all of those episodes. Loads of stuff, including loads of bonuses. But more pertinently and relevant to this week, if you haven't heard it, my series, which we called The Lionel of Flanders, where I went to those three Belgian races and kind of made an episode a day for 5 days, still available. And, you know, hopefully we'll be
voted the best friends special.
It was
offering of last year, I believe, Lionel, wasn't it?
Yeah, I had spent a lot of time.
You reminded me of that this morning.
I spent 2 or 3 days solidly voting for it in the listener survey. So
We heard about Gaviria's fondness for mowing the grass there in that little clip from our friend's special. He was missing from Milan San Remo, of course, and we had been speaking a lot in the last few weeks about the quick step, you know, threat at Milan San Remo. It didn't really materialize, did it? Philippe Gilbert had a problem. Their best rider, having at one point had four options to win the race, they ended up best result 19th. Elia Viviani, very disappointing. Very disappointing.
One of their worst ever monument performances. But I would suggest that, you know, that doesn't mean that they're going to have an awful spring. They tend to bring it or pull it round at some point, don't they?
The other bad luck story from the race. Well, Andre Greipel had been looking extremely good, actually, and you know, very very strong, and he has always threatened to ride really well in the classics. You know, even Tour of Flanders and races like that. And so he's going to sit those out this year, which is a great shame at his age. You know, he is a fading force, isn't he, as we said about 10 years ago. But Mark Cavendish, what a dreadful start to the season he's having. Three really bad crashes. I mean, not just crashes, but bad crashes. The first one, okay, it was a slow speed, but he obviously suffered concussion there. The second one, the team time trial at Tirreno Adriatico on day one, that was a nasty one. His face was bashed up. This was the worst of the lot. It certainly looked the worst of the lot. I mean, when you saw it, you know, it was just awful to watch, and you feared for him. The injuries don't seem to have been that bad, remarkably. A broken rib, another broken rib. But Daniel, have you heard from Cavendish? How is he? What sort of mood is he in after that?
Yeah, I spoke to him briefly or exchanged messages with him on Saturday night, so on the day of the race, and he was okay. He was in pretty good spirits. He hurt his ankle. I think he broke another rib. He wasn't talking yet about when we will see him back in action. But he was already I think feeling pretty beaten up, certainly in his morale, before San Remo. So after those first two crashes this year, the one in Abu Dhabi and Tirreno, and the one in Tirreno was, well, it had sort of mechanical causes. I think he went over a speed bump, and I think his bike took some of the impact and he came off. I think he sort of resents and is worried that this image is growing and is spreading of him as someone who is very accident prone and who crashes a lot. Obviously, after the Tour de France last year, when he crashed out in that now infamous collision with Peter Sagan. He has had these four crashes now since, well, including that one at the Tour de France. And, he doesn't feel that really represents his riding style or how he usually goes about his business. And he was also very much looking forward to this season, having had a really good winter. And even after those two setbacks early in the year, on Saturday at Milan San Remo, he sort of counted himself out. He told Dimension Data, his team, that they didn't need to work for him on Saturday. He would work for other riders. But he was feeling fantastic on Saturday. So he got over the Cipressa in good shape, and they were coming towards the Poggio. And he sort of regretted at that point having told the team not to work for him. But there's enough time before the Tour de France for him to get his season back on track. But of course, it's the last year of his contract with Dimension Data as well, which brings another layer of anxiety and angst.
It's interesting, isn't it? Cavendish, Greipel, both ruled out. Had they been there and had they survived the Poggio, again, it could have been a different outcome, with couple of extra bodies there. You don't know. I don't know off the top of my head how many teammates they might have had there. I think Greipel still had a few. Again, that might have been a factor in Nibali holding off the rest of them.
Yeah, on Cavendish, while we were on our book tour around the country a week or so ago, we were asked a couple of times whether we thought Mark Cavendish would equal Eddy Merckx's record of stage wins at the Tour de France. Merckx, of course, is on 34. Wait, he's declared on 34. Let's face it, he's not going to add a 35th, is he, Eddy Merckx?
It's unlikely.
Unless he fancies coming out of retirement to an honorary start at the Tour next year in Brussels. Mark Cavendish is on 30, and we've wavered one way or the other whether he would be able to draw level or perhaps even surpass that record. I mean, for the first thing, there were so many more split stages back in Merckx's day, and a lot of his wins were also time trials, and of course he could win on the flat in the mountains, so it's not really comparing like for like, but it is the outright record. I don't know that this terrible early season, whether you believe in kind of luck or not, you have to feel that Cavendish's luck cannot continue to be this bad going forward. He should be due a more lucky break at some point. So who knows? I mean, he's got plenty of time to get into really good shape for the Tour de France, and you never know. You wouldn't write him off and put a couple of stage wins past him this year, and then once he's within two, it might be possible. But if you had to...
Well, something we always overlook, or we don't attach enough importance to Napalm, is who's he competing against. And if there happens to be one rider, one other sprinter who's who's absolutely flying when the Tour de France comes around, then it becomes a whole lot harder. But just looking at the
Hodgie.
I don't think Hodgie will be doing the Tour this year, but just looking at the sprinters who are likely to be at the Tour de France, Kittel, although he was obviously dominant last year in the sprints at the Tour, I would suggest that he's never quite established an impregnable sort of stranglehold of the sprinting throne. He always gives his rivals some sort of glimmer of hope, and we saw that again at Milan San Remo at the weekend, just how vulnerable he is on certain types of course. The young guns, Ewan, certainly sent a pretty resounding message, although he didn't win on Saturday, that he's incredibly fast. And Gaviria, everyone is talking up, and Cavendish himself has talked up, but there are a couple of sort of notes of of caution when it comes to Gaviria. I've heard a couple of people say that he really needs to keep his feet on the floor, suggesting that he's someone who, you know, might struggle a little bit with fame and the kind of adulation that he's going to get in Colombia. That's obviously speculation. But just regarding Cavendish himself, I mean, I said at the event when we did get that question that I think he's never better than when his back's against the wall and that he's being written off, which happens, well, regularly now, has happened regularly in his career. And, you know, I compared it to 2016, which was his last really good season when he went back onto the track and he went into a world where people were writing him off again on the track. They said, you know, he's been away for a long time. He hasn't got enough experience. There are guys who are better than him. And, you know, he really thrived in that environment when he was being doubted. And maybe we're nearing that point again, you know, as the spring wears on, when people are going to start saying, well, that's it, he's finished, he's got no chance at the Tour de France, and he'll pull something out.
Who knows? We better be careful here, because in the last couple of weeks we've been accused of talking too much about Mark Cavendish, and also of being anti-Mark Cavendish. Our latest iTunes review actually said that we hate Mark Cavendish. Very
no,
odd.
No, I think that was saying if you hate Mark Cavendish, and if you hate Team Sky, then we're the podcast for no.
Oh, okay.
No, I think
I misunderstood yeah, it. No, you've obviously been studying it longer than I have.
I've tried to unpick it in on 6, 7, 8, 9 levels, really. You know, to you know, fuel.
If you want to
fuel
leave
for
a,
the
a,
engine, you, fuel for the engine, Rich. You know, fuel for the
if
engine.
I'm looking forward to the blog on that, Lionel. If you want to leave a positive review on iTunes, by all means, do so. You didn't mention there, Daniel, the Atomic Tadpole.
No, forgot about the Atomic Tadpole.
I think
quite disappointed.
He's got to be the greatest threat.
Well,
no?
Yeah, and I was quite disappointed that he didn't have a tilt at Milan San Remo. I was quite surprised when some Dutch colleagues told me that he wasn't even going to go. And, you know, even we said that Kittel didn't particularly impress us on Saturday, but I do feel that Kittel has left it too late in his career to really, well, to go through 4 or 5 of these races of San Remo's and just get the measure of the thing, in the same way that Cipollini did, in the same way that to a certain extent Pataki did, sort of big, powerful sprinters who, with time, actually figured out how to go about it. But Kittel, I think is he 31 now or 30? I think he's probably left it a bit late.
Okay, so Kittel will probably win Milan Sanremo next year. Chaps, we should wind things up for this week. We're looking ahead to the Cobbled Classics resuming, E3 kicking things off. Next week we'll have a report from the Tour of Catalonia, which is going on at the moment. Hannah Troop, our lady in the desert, is there. Not very desert-like in Catalonia, but she'll have a dispatch from there next week. We look forward to that. In the meantime, we should wrap things up. Lionel, thank you very much.
Thank you, Richard.
Daniel, thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Cycling Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please rate us and leave a review on Facebook and iTunes. Just search online for the Cycling Podcast. This episode was edited and produced by Adam Bowie.